Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. You know, every year, the Maryland Humanities Council has one Maryland, one book. And we're always lucky to be one of the chosen ones to do the interviews about the books. This year is somebody whose books I've read, most of them, not all of them, but most of them. And I like to tell the truth, at least partially. He's a great poet and writer, one of America's great writers, who's now taken this country by storm, especially this last book he's written, which is the One Man and One Book, is called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. And Sherman Alexie is in our studio and in Baltimore. And Sherman, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's been a long time since we've been actually looking at each other.
It has been.
We've been doing the radio call-in interview.
Phone, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Been since 1996 when you wrote Indian Killer.
Yeah, that's when I was, you know, pretty and skinny.
We were all pretty and skinny back
then.
Yeah,
no. I have great chest hair now.
And you had longer hair then.
Yeah, I'm very distinguished.
Yeah, you cut your hair and you...
Yeah, I'm you know, really appropriate looking now.
By design.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, even as an Indian, once you get past a certain age and your hair is long, you look like an idiot.
That's why I cut mine.
Yeah.
You look stupid after a while.
You look stupid. I mean, even if you're an Indian, you look a little silly. So, and my hair isn't at all thinning. It's never going to. But
that was pretty thick head of hair.
Yeah, but I always worried I'd become one of those, you know, balding dudes with the long gray ponytail.
Oh, yeah, right. Nothing on top.
Oh, yeah, nothing on top. Like four strands on top and then the long ponytail, as if the ultimate volume of hair somehow compensates for, you know, the mislocation of it.
Well, you look good, man.
Oh, thank you.
Coat and tie.
Yeah, I'm dressed up for you. It's just for you.
I appreciate it. I took my tie off. I feel like I should run back outside and maybe put it back on.
Maybe you should.
I don't know.
you can be Edward Murrow, you know.
I could.
Yes.
I could. I like Edward Murrow.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was going to ask you this. This is nothing about your book, but I'm asking you this today because, and I'm going to jump right into your book and the other stuff that you've been writing about. But last night, I was up late watching Democracy Now! Because they were covering the execution of Troy Davis.
Oh, yeah.
And it just grabbed me so deeply. I wrote about it this morning and put it out on the blog. I'm just curious your thoughts. This has nothing to do with your book. I'm just really curious your thoughts on that. It's just really how you relate to that and what you think about it.
Well, it strongly appears we executed an innocent man.
Yeah.
But there's an interesting race thing going on here because this is getting a lot more attention than the execution in Texas.
A brewer who dragged Bird to his death behind a truck?
No. Last year? Of a white man who supposedly killed his kids, set the house on fire. And the forensic evidence was conducted by a person who has no expertise.
Absolutely.
And many fire forensic folks came forward to talk about how he was absolutely wrong,
right?
And he got executed. So
anyway,
I find it interesting that there's sort of a strange racial dynamic when the white guy doesn't get as much attention, when the probably innocent white guy doesn't get as much attention as the probably innocent black guy.
That's true.
So that's a very interesting dynamic to me. But, you know, the fact is we've executed innocent people. We already have.
Right.
And it's barbaric. It's barbaric. And I don't know if you saw the debate, Republican debate, where Rick Perry, you know, bragged about being an executioner. And people in the audience cheered. Now, I'm no fan of monsters. You know, and I've been in prisons. Mm-hmm. I've done workshops. I have relatives in prison. And by and large, I'm of the belief that most people who are in prison belong in prison. Not in the conditions necessarily. And my cousin drug mule shouldn't be in there with murderers. But I'm not a typical bleeding heart liberal, even though I'm a bleeding heart liberal. But when it comes to crime, so I'm not somebody who thinks people should go unpunished
absolutely not.
Yeah, but so the concept of in executing, we have an imperfect system because it's a human system.
Yep.
So even if I was in favor of the death penalty, I don't trust human bureaucracy enough to always be right. And it's amazing to me that the most vocal, you know, proponents of the death penalty are the most anti-government. You know, big government,
right.
Anti-big government.
Absolutely.
What's bigger government than capital punishment? Deciding who gets to live or die.
Right.
And if people got represented equally, if people had, you know, the same lawyers, the same money, you know, in some level playing field, perhaps then I wouldn't feel so anti-death penalty. But that's not the case.
And what you, where you described your feelings about people who are in prison deserve to be there, and that, you know, it reminds me of something of a subtext strain that runs through your books for me, which is an unblinking honesty of your perceptions that makes truth difficult to wrestle with for anybody who reads it, whether you're Indian, white, or anybody else.
Yeah, I mean...
Not difficult, but challenges.
It's tough for me to do this. I catch a lot of crap.
I'm sure you do.
And I'm the thing is, I am as left as anybody in this country. I'm you go left and then you go another couple miles, and you know there's
Sherman.
There's a sign leading to where I'm farther left, like, you know, five more miles. You know, there's no more gas stations for 50 miles, and then I'm past that. But I guess, you know, I'm really I'm suspicious of my own beliefs. Mm-hmm. I'm highly critical of myself. And I know the fundamentalist strains in me. I know my reactionism. So, you know, I'm suspicious of myself. So by definition, I have to be suspicious of the people like me. So, you know, I'm a liberal who distrusts liberals just as much as I distrust conservatives.
And in your look at, like, here, the book we're talking about today, the not your latest book, but the book that is the one Maryland book, The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, that has been on the bestseller list for how long now, New York Times?
Since it came out. It's 4.5 years.
Yeah. It's been 4.5 years? Wow.
Yeah. In fact, it's actually 4 years. 2007, 4 years. 4 years.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So, but in this book, this is like an unflinching look at, among many things, but one of the things of poverty, of reservation life, and sometimes if you read this book, I can see why some people on the Indian side of the world will go, man, why are you exposing all this stuff about us?
Yeah.
Why are you saying all these negative things about our world?
Yeah, my own reservation. I'm actually visiting the high school. Soon on my reservation, and I haven't visited the high school since my literary career started. A teacher emailed me and said that students there are really struggling with the book and are very angry and really want to talk to me.
Wow.
So
when are you going to do that?
I haven't set a date yet, but it's going to be this fall.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So, but you know, you know, I don't think the reservation has changed that much. You know, my family still lives there. My siblings and my mom. And, you know, the stuff that happened when I was that age is still happening. So I'm very curious about self-perception and why the young folks there don't see the social problems in the way I do and did. And it seems to me it's the same case. Maybe for some people, in order to survive the poverty and the oppression and the racism, you have to sort of live in a state of denial about it. You have to be... You know, the sovereignty, you have to be even sovereign to yourself and not letting anything touch you. You have to put this armor on. And the armor takes on this notion of positivity, which this sort of crazy blindness. When you're a brown writer, when you're a minority writer, people so often expect you to be a social worker, too. Your literature is supposed to provide uplift.
Right.
And that's not my job.
What's your job?
My job is to write what I know. But, I mean, literature is not filled with happy-go-lucky stories.
Right.
I mean, literature, any people's, is the story of pain and dissatisfaction and loneliness, you know. And the thing is, you know, nobody ever looks at Hemingway and says, you know, I wish he was happier. You know, nobody reads Faulkner and thinks, you know, if he would have had more happy endings, it would be better. You know, or you know, Fitzgerald, you know, the Great Gatsby is a really big downer. You know, everybody dies at the end. Woman gets run over the car, you know, this big guy's glasses is looking at everybody. But so the judgment placed on minority literature and women's literature is completely, and it's put on us by people of our own communities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really... condescending, diminishing, unfair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm writing for my people and about my people, but I'm also you know, I want to be competing with the Jonathan Franzen of the world.
Well, that's the world you're in, though.
Yeah. And
that's the group of the genre of writers you're in.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
Zadie
exactly.
Smith, he.
I mean, and I think a lot of people are happy about that. I mean, you know, we have amazing writers who are older than me, amazing, who've had amazing careers and whose books are still, you know, vital to me to reread. Scott Momaday and Leslie Silko and James
right.
Welch. But I'm the first one to have what I have, this sort of literary / pop culture / multimedia fame.
What do you think that is? Is it the contents of your work, the way you approach multimedia, the way you look at the world? I mean, what do you think that is?
I'm funny.
You are funny, man.
Yeah.
I saw you on Colbert.
Yeah.
That was really funny.
I think a big part of it is funny. I'm funny. Uh-huh. I'm funny. I think that's a big part of it. I mean, when I started out, too, I was young,
uh-huh.
you know, photogenic,
right.
you know,
uh-huh.
less so now.
No. Don't self-deprecate.
Okay. Yeah, my therapist says self-loathing is just another form of arrogance. So, but I mean, that was part of it. You know, I think I had, you know, funny, I had multimedia talents before literature was so multimedia. You know,
well, it's your generation too, right?
Yeah, I think my set of talents would maybe work really well in this internet era, you know. And I think that was a big part of it, is I simply was the first multimedia Indian artist.
I've thought about that. I was thinking about other Indian authors and writers, poets, actors.
Yeah.
But there aren't many I could think of that crossed all the genres.
Yeah, and they were all academics.
A lot of them are academics, right. They are. Oh, yes. You mean the writers,
yeah,
especially.
Yeah, they're all academics right. from academic families. Most of them are second-generation college. And some of them are
yes.
third-generation college.
Yes.
So
That's a whole world of the Indian world that people don't even know about in America.
Exactly.
Right?
The elite.
Right. The elite, right.
I'm also the first Indian writer who really – to hit big, who really came out of extreme poverty. And
right.
And parents who didn't graduate high school.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
I think that might be true.
Yeah. I mean,
right, right, right,
I've
right.
racked my brain.
Right, right, right. I'm doing the same thing. I'm racking
yeah.
my brain now.
Yeah.
Going through a list of all the people. Yeah.
I mean, like the American Indian movement, all the people who started it, they all came out of, you know, Russell Means was an accountant, right?
Right. There were very few. Right, right.
So
John was a res boy. John Trudell was a res boy.
Yeah, yeah. So in a lot of ways, Native Art was about people from outside the res writing their way back to the res.
Right.
And I was from the res writing my way off the res. So I think the direction is what really changed.
So and this really kind of encompasses, made me think of this, but I was just thinking there's some ways encompasses this book, The Absolute True Diary of Apartheid Indian, but it also reminds me of the movie you made, Fancy Dancing.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing. It made me think of that immediately as you said you were going back to your reservation to the high school that you didn't graduate from, and you went to
yeah.
a white high school.
Yes.
But that you're going back to talk like he went back.
Yeah.
From a totally different world to that place and had to deal with the being an urban guy, not being stuck in this world that he came from. He didn't really want to be back in.
Yeah. I mean, well, one of the things I'm going to tell him is, you know, the reservation, you know, I don't know why reservations have become so sacred. We didn't make them. It was a white military construction. They were designed as rural concentration camps where Indians were supposed to go and die and disappear. So why have they become sacred? And beyond all that, you know, depending on the time frame, you know, more than 70% of natives live off the reservation.
Exactly. They live in urban areas.
So
right.
It's actually being Indian means being urban. And being Indian, I mean, we never stayed in one place. You know, we roamed. You know, we came from, as we all did, from Africa. So
ultimately, that's true.
You know, yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. You know, Adam and Eve were black, and shh. Freak out. I'll freak out even your liberal white listeners.
Well, most of my listeners are probably as many African Americans as white, so you won't freak everybody out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. Exactly. So they'll be
not
happy
more.
Right
not
now.
More.
Right now, there's some black folks cheering.
Right.
Yeah, I like that Indian guy. But so I mean, the basic human desire is to roam, is to go. Not to stay in one place, it's to go.
Right.
And for most of my tribe's history, we traveled. You know, we moved from place to place. We went where the food was. And So the idea of staying in one place your whole life.
Yeah.
That's not traditional.
I agree.
This never occurred to me. I felt so guilty in my literary career. I thought I was doing something so un-Indian.
By moving?
By moving and traveling and telling stories and roaming the world.
And you love it.
Yeah. And then I was on stage once and I realized, wait, I travel the world telling stories. How Indian is that? And for all these years, I let these casino-loving, golf-playing Indians, you know, convince me I was less Indian than them, make me feel that way, you know, and talk about assimilation, you know, a casino.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, celebrating the exploitation of other people's weaknesses.
So what do you think it is? I mean, do you think it is the kind of colonization and destruction of Indian culture in America, or attacking Indians in America for its whole history, 500 years, whatever it's been, 600 years. But in some ways, it's like also a colonization of the mentality that changed a culture because they were colonized.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, a colonization of the mind. It's a, you know, overused academic term. But I mean, you know, in this internet age, I like to call that the self-replicating virus.
That's a better way to put it.
Yeah.
I'll use that from now on.
Yeah, the self-replicating virus. Yeah, of course. Thank you. Self-replicating virus.
Good.
And what we do now is when the tribe gets power and money is they start behaving as bad as any white corporation does.
Right.
I mean, there's tribes banishing people. I mean, there's tribes, you know, recolonizing the land that was taken from them. But, you know, generations have passed and people have worked hard to own this land and tribes are annexing. Tribes are affecting elections, local elections in really mm-hmm. disturbing. And I mean, one of the things that always kills me is I don't know why. I'm always puzzled why white liberals love Res Indians so much. I mean, when you talk about Res Indians, you're talking pro-life, pro-war, pro-gun. There's no separation of church and state.
Homophobic.
Homophobic. I mean, incredibly religious, very conservative. I mean, you know, the joke is, you know, Res Indians are just rednecks with better hair. So there's this whole mistaken identity, this whole perception about who Indians are. I mean, I love who we are in so many ways, but the bad stuff, the negative stuff doesn't get talked about by white liberals because they're afraid of being perceived as racist. Indians don't want to talk about it because it's being viewed as airing dirty laundry. And right. White racists only focus on the negative things without talking about the positive stuff we do. And it's my job as a writer to cover the whole gamut of Indianness, from the worst behavior to the best behavior, from the villains to the heroes. And often that's all contained in the same person. I mean,
it's not all of us, though,
yeah,
isn't it?
I'm a hero and a villain. I'm good
right.
and I'm bad.
Right.
I'm evil and I'm saintly, from minute to minute.
Right.
And
it's true. And as you were saying that, one of the things I thought about was I was thinking about conversations I've had with people recently about being Jewish, and my questions that they really people don't like, and I raise these questions all the time to people, is that it's the same thing. Indian questions, why it made me think of this, is that what have we done as a people with our power in the last 60 years, whether it's in Israel or America? What have we done with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, good people, but what are we not seeing? What have we done to not really make this thing a better place? I mean, it's the same kind of dynamic, mm-hmm. I think. People just don't want to look at the warts inside of your own.
Yeah, and then the status of being the ultimate victim.
Yes, the victim.
Gives you serious power.
Right.
Even when you're not being the victim, even when you're victimizing.
Right.
So you can get away with a lot of stuff. As an Indian, I get away with so much. I can stand up in front of huge crowds of non-Indians, in front of white people, and just hammer on them all night, and they love me for it. You know,
beat me.
Yeah, I turn them all into St. Francis. I am the eternal rose bush. Which gets me off because I'm Catholic, too. So
practicing?
I'm always practicing, never getting any better.
We're talking with Sherman Alexie. He is in Maryland because his book that he wrote 4 years ago, incredible book that put him all of his books, I think I've read them, have been phenomenal. But put him over the top here. It's called The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. New York Times bestseller. He'll be traveling around the state talking, and he's actually this Saturday, tell you now, we'll tell you at the end of the hour as well, will be at the Baltimore Book Festival at 2 p.m. on Leary Salon in Mount Vernon Place. So you don't want to miss that, and we'll give you a list of all the other places he'll be in the next 2 days so you can catch him wherever you are. But coming back to I want to slide back to the book for a moment, because what made me think of this character, Arnold Spirit, because you're a junior too, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'm Sherman Alexie Jr.
Yeah, you're right.
And he's Arnold Spirit Jr.
Junior. So this is the autobiography that's not an autobiography.
Yeah. There was a student at Goucher. I spoke at Goucher College who said she writes fiction, but it's very autobiographical. And it was funny. She goes, I just call it autofiction.
Yeah, that's...
Which I don't think I've ever heard that term before, and
I
it really
either.
Hit me. Yeah.
Doesn't it make sense?
Yeah. And I thought, wow, that's what I do. I write autofiction.
Because a lot of your stuff is infused with autofiction.
Yeah. A student taught me.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, her name was Sophia. So if you're listening, Sophia, thank you.
Thank you, Sophia. I love auto. I'm going to steal that. There's another... I come up with two great phrases now.
Yeah.
Autofiction. So this kid on the res, this is why this is so important, I think, just in terms of what you wrestle with in this book. You know, I mean, when I first picked this book up 4 years ago and read it, mm-hmm. they just gave me a new copy, but I have an older copy.
Liar.
I am not lying, sir. My wife is outside the door. She'll tell you the truth.
Okay.
So this book, let's talk about a couple of things in here that really hit me. One of the things that, there's a line I'm sure everybody says to you over and over again with this book, but I think it's important. Poverty sucks.
Yeah. Doesn't teach you nobility. Yeah. I mean, the cliches about poverty. You know, pick yourself up by your bootstraps and this whole idea of it being something romantic. And it's still present.
The
thing that nobody ever talks about, I haven't heard really, the internet is turning the country libertarian.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's exactly what's happening. The country is turning libertarian because of the internet and because all the power structure, all those dudes are libertarian enemas. And, mm-hmm. and
libertarian enemas. Like
yes.
That.
So the country has turned away from the idea of helping the poor, which, by the way, is a very religious thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing to me that this so-called religious party, the Republicans – have somehow turned away from the idea of something called a republic government, which is supposed to represent and be for all the people.
Right.
Have turned away and are, defunding and cutting social programs everywhere. But the notion of taking care of each other is all gone. I mean, I wouldn't be here without about 25 different social programs. So... You know,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
Yeah,
and
I'm an Indian, and I'm saying this right here and right now. The United States government, until very recently, worked well. It started falling apart in the Clinton presidency. I mean, can you imagine the laughter that would occur if we were trying to impeach a president now for blowjobs?
That was insane.
You know. I mean, even conservatives would probably say, what were we thinking? Considering, and as we were doing that, the 9/11 plans were being hatched.
Right.
So while we were distracted by blowjobs,
right.
You know, 9/11 was being planned.
Right.
But I'm an Indian saying the government works. There's 1,000 programs that work.
Yeah.
And this anti-government thing is utterly libertarian. It's unpatriotic, it's selfish, it's cynical, and this is a member of the colonized people saying this,
it was the social programs and the people who wrap themselves around you, some of whom are alluded to in many of your works,
yeah.
And in this book as well.
Yeah. I mean, going to a white community.
Right.
But the thing is, this was a very conservative white community. Extremely conservative, like as far left as I am, this town is as far right. and I'm sure I don't know them as well anymore, but I'm sure I have all sorts of classmates who are Tea Party members.
I'm sure you
do. People I love. There's probably women I slept with, you know, that are Tea Party members now. I mean, I dated 9 women like Sarah Palin, you know, basketball playing right wing maniacs. They're hot. So I know them. And but the thing is, they were amazing because, you know, there's this willful blindness that goes on with conservatives. You know, all of a sudden I was the good Indian. Uh-huh. And then I was just Sherman. You know, they could have all these.
You were the only Indian, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Until my sisters. And then, but it's easy to destroy their racism because, you know, I was better than their kids at everything.
You're smarter.
Yeah, smarter, better athlete.
And you could play basketball.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I did drama. I you know, I was a great public speaker. So they had to readjust their worldview. And now 42 kids go to that school from our reservation. They have a shuttle that goes from the res to the school. And you know, that gets me so mad because I was so vilified.
Because did you have to walk like Arnold Spirit had to walk to school from the res?
A couple times, and I had to hitchhike quite a few times. And they have a shuttle now, and I was, you know, laughing around with my mom. I said, they should put my name on the shuttle. It should be the Sherman Alexi effing shuttle, and then in parentheses, to get your way to a better life.
So what is it? I mean, this is part of the heart of this book, which is when you said to me that earlier today you spoke at Morgan State University, where this will be broadcast this evening, it's being broadcast now, that there were inner city kids from our schools, public city schools, majority of whom were black, African-American, who came
about
to
95%.
I'm sure, yeah. Absolutely, heard you speak. And I said to you when you said that to me before we started that the absolute true diary of a part-time Indian in many ways is their story too. It's a res story. It's an inner city story.
Yeah. It's a barrio story. It's a small farm town story.
Small farm town story. Exactly. It's a holler story in Appalachia.
Yeah. Kids being trapped by their tribes, whatever their tribe is. Parents seeking to utterly define you as a child. I mean, the letters I get tons of letters from high school students. And one day, a couple of years ago, I got 2 packages, one from a very exclusive private school back east here, mm-hmm. and another one from a school on the Crow Indian Reservation.
Mm.
And, you know, the differences between them, you were stark. But, you know, the paper, the private school letter paper was just that soft, cottony stuff.
Right.
I wanted to sleep on it. It was so nice. And the letters were all typed up and printed and beautiful and smart, uh-huh. and, you know. It's the first personal letters I've ever gotten that had, you know, a bibliography. And fan letters of bibliographies. And then the Crow letters were, of course, not as educated. The paper wasn't as nice. Often just notebook paper torn out.
Right.
So there were hanging chads on the letters. But the letters from the rich, privileged folks and the disadvantaged res folks had the same theme, you know, feeling trapped by my ancestors.
So, there's several things I want to ask at one time, so I have to ask them one at a time.
So, in other words, those inner city kids, of course, are trapped by circumstances, trapped by their parents' choices, trapped by the government's choices. And in this recessionary income and in this era where the difference between rich and poor is just going bigger and bigger and bigger, more and more their choices are being made for them. And this book about an individual's decision to, you know, ignore all that, to really turn his back on his traditions in order to pursue a better personal life, you know, is a huge deal. Because the thing I did is I turned my back on all sorts of wonderful, amazing stuff.
You, Sherman Alexi, did.
I did. Because the horrible and the awful was all enmeshed with it.
So, okay, if you take Arnold Spirit Jr., Sherman Alexi Jr., and Arnold Spirit, the character and the man who wrote the book both had encephalitis.
Hydrocephalus.
Hydrocephalus, excuse me.
Yeah.
The water on the brain was right? Were geeks and picked on as a kid in their worlds. And his act of throwing, when he saw his mother's name in the geometry book, saying, "But they're giving me books that belong to my mother."
Yeah.
You know, the same thing inner city kid would see as well, right? and hit the teacher in the head. But then the teacher's liberal white guilt came in, nice guy, and said, you need to go somewhere else to do your stuff.
Yeah.
So
I didn't have that teacher.
You didn't have that teacher.
No. That was the completely fictional part. I made the decision on my own.
By yourself.
Yeah.
What was the instant?
The geometry book. That was real.
That was real.
Yeah. My mom's name and my mom, her maiden name in a geometry book. My geometry book. I mean, the absolute injustice of it.
Absolutely unjust.
Yeah.
But it happens now, today.
Oh, yeah.
All the
oh,
time.
Yeah. You know, and the distance between, you know, people talk about the technology is going to make everything more equal. I mean, they had technology. You know, it's not like I was writing on stone tablets. But, you know, at Wellpinit, we had one TSR-80 computer, the res school.
Wellpinit is with the res, in
res,
Washington.
One Radio Shack TSR-80 computer. When I got to Reardon, we had an amazing computer math teacher who was way ahead of his time. They had 15 of the early computers, you know, the 1980 computers. I'm not even – they were Macs.
Wow.
And here are some PCs there too, and just early forerunners of all the stuff we have. And so even then, I all of a sudden had access to technology that I hadn't had before. I mean, we didn't have a Bunsen burner on the res at that point. And so the idea that somehow or another all these iPads are going to be in the hands of all these poor kids is such a delusional
right.
idea from both the left and the right.
Right.
You know, the idea that technology is somehow going to make for a better education. And if that was true, then why are our numbers
right.
rapidly descending?
It's the teachers, the books, it's the place.
Yeah. And also, why does the economic collapse coincide with the rise of the internet? I mean.
Good question.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not smart enough about economics to know, but why isn't anybody asking that question? It seems to me that everybody, left and right, is celebrating the internet.
What?
And
it's the technology itself that's putting people out of work.
Yeah.
I mean, that creating a society where they're no longer needed.
Yeah. And it's putting enormous power. I mean, world-changing power. You know, forget dictators. Forget Hitler. Forget Mussolini. You know, forget Obama. Mark Zuckerberg
right.
is the most powerful person in the world.
Right. He's got us sucked into that Facebook.
Yeah. This callow, you know, immature, uneducated, spoiled, uninteresting human being runs the world.
Mm. Sherman Alexie, we're going to take a short break and come right back. We're here with Sherman Alexie. He is the Maryland Humanities. He's not. His book is The One Man of One Book, but he's here because of the book,
yeah.
which he wrote, The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are here with Sherman Alexie, who's in Maryland, traveling around with Maryland Humanities Council. His book, The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, is the One Maryland, One Book 2011. An amazing book it is, and a fascinating character is Sherman Alexie. You can meet him. We'll give you all the lists on our website, steinershow.org, but tonight he'll be over at the Chesapeake College in Y Mills in the Eastern Shore. If you're going that way, you can stop in at 7 o'clock at the Todd Performing Arts Center. But over the weekend, on Saturday, September 24th at 2 o'clock, he'll be at the Baltimore Book Festival at the Literary Salon in Mount Vernon Place. And for a more intimate discussion, you should enjoy that a great deal. And the other places we'll put up on the web, and you can see them all in Frederick and other places. He'll be in Cumberland. So this book and you, and when you run away, sometimes you have to run away to survive,
mm-hmm.
right? So you run away to this world, this white world, and you can blossom as your own power.
Yeah.
But you said you had to. So you said earlier you had to desert what was left behind. You had to just leave it, and all the beautiful things the ugly things, but also some of the beauty you left behind.
Oh yeah, yeah,
right?
I mean, probably more beautiful stuff than awful stuff.
So as you wrestle with it all, how do you marry the two? Can you marry the two? Do they come back together in some weave or no?
You know, I think it's going to take me a lifetime to recover what took me about half an hour of decision-making to lose.
Uh-huh.
So slowly make your way back to the good stuff. And I think writing is a way of doing that. The whole storytelling process is a way of connecting to my traditional roots.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I married an Indian woman. I have Indian kids. We're very urban. I'm very privileged now because of my career. But I'm surrounded by Indians still.
That's interesting. In the in Seattle.
Yeah,
in the
with yeah. I mean, I sleep with an Indian. So I'm not a whole lot of famous Indian men can say that.
Amen to that. Amen to that. what I was asking earlier, I mean, talking about what you felt were the beautiful parts that you don't.
The songs, the dancing, powwows. I mean, just the sense of seeing the same people every day, that uh-huh. small town thing, but in an Indian way.
Uh-huh.
The shared. I mean, one thing that's changed, though, is a class, you know, with casinos, there's introduced a class system, you know, within tribes and among tribes. That there's a class system now, and that wasn't that way when I was growing up.
Class, because folks were built around the casinos make a lot of money, and those who are not running them
yeah,
do not.
The power structure makes the money, and the difference between rich and poor Indians has increased the same way as it has for everybody else in the country.
The class divide is everywhere.
Yes, and casinos have introduced that.
Interesting.
But when I was growing up, everybody was pretty much equally poor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my family was viewed as actually rich because my dad had farmland, you know, that we rented out. So, you know, in a good year to raise, you know, four or five kids and any number of cousins living with us at any given point, my dad would make $15,000 a year. And that was considered a lot of money. You know, it's of course, by every other standard, it's extreme poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody was equal. And now it's changed. People have more money. And, you know, you see it in the cars they drive on the res. You see it in the houses they live in.
The newer trucks and the Cadillacs.
Yeah. Right. And in less so in my tribe, but in other tribes, you go on visit the reservation and you can see the class system simply based on front yards.
Mm-hmm.
And with a newly introduced class system comes all the class problems that exist for the rest of the people.
And we in America still play this game of of the mystical spiritual Indian.
Every Indian, every single Indian talks to animals.
Right.
Yeah. We try. I was talking to a squirrel before I came into the studio.
What did it say?
He flipped me off. because the positive stereotypes are so amazing. They assign us superhuman talents that will accept them, you know, since the negative stereotypes, you know, completely dehumanize us. I mean, who wouldn't want to be a superhero of the spirit?
Right.
I mean, it's an awesome thing, and plus it gets you laid. I mean, really, that's the basic motivation for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of becoming a desired person, you know, when you've spent most of your history being colonized and vilified, I mean, it's a drug. It's, you know, and Indians are addicted to that attention as much as any other thing we're addicted to. I'm addicted to it.
Right.
I mean, my whole job is based on getting white people to love me.
Or to buy your books and read them, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's like the a couple months back, my friend Sean Ware was in the studio where you're sitting now. He was in Kiowa and lives on the Wind River Res, married to a Arapaho woman. And we had this conversation. One of the things we talked about was his spiritual way of looking at the world and the people in the Arapaho land. But that we started talking about this whole the whole world of spiritual hustlers. that can just throw one over on, especially white people.
Yeah.
To say, you know, give me $15,000 and...
Yeah, I'll lead you through a sacred traditional experience.
Right,
and,
right.
I mean, that white guy in Arizona killed people.
Oh, and the sweat.
Yeah.
That was insane.
Yeah.
Sweats can kill you.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be so careful, you know. And the thing is, I mean, you know, I've made it, you know, most everywhere I talk, especially in New Age areas, I mean, I tell them guidelines for this stuff. You can leave any time you want to. There is no
right.
shame. There is no rules. If you are losing it, you can get out and nobody cares.
Yell for all my relations and they'll open the flap and out you go.
Yeah.
Or whatever you have to say.
And then like four or five other dudes or women will follow you because they were thinking the same thing. It's like, I am not this spiritual. I don't believe in God this much. So, I mean, it's not a torture test. It's an altered consciousness test, you know, altered consciousness. But it's not a torture test. It's not Guantanamo, you know, inside cedar poles. You know, so number one, you can leave when you want to. Number two, the second anybody asks you for money, run.
Run.
Two basic rules.
There are two basic rules and important rules. The one of the things I think about in terms of when I was rereading this and thinking about some of the other things you've written is that there's this. We talked a little about it on the air. The subtext of homophobia.
Oh yeah.
That you seem to tackle a lot, and that it's almost as if. Leaving the res unleashes an openness. On the other hand, the roots of it all, it was there before. That got lost somewhere in the res, right?
Once again, it goes back to the idea. Well, reservations were a white creation. And homophobia in the Indian world is a Christian creation. You know, in many tribes, most tribes, androgyny was magical. And in most tribes, women could be warriors and men could be teepee keepers, housekeepers. Gender roles were not strictly defined. And in fact, I mean, if you look at us, you know, Indian men and women traditionally all have the same exact hairstyle. And is there anything more androgynous than a 22-year-old Indian guy? I mean, every 22-year-old Indian guy from behind looks like a hot woman. So you know, the notion of homophobia among the most androgynous males in the world. Even our songs sound like crying. I mean,
yeah.
We're an emotive androgyn. I mean, we're the ones who wear the bright feathers to dance. I mean, you know, we're pretty. You know, I'm pretty. I'm still pretty. I'm a 44-year-old man, and I'm pretty. So,
pretty Sherman Alexis.
Yeah. So the homophobia is brought in. Once again, it's accepting colonized thought as traditional. You know, I have a friend, a Navajo, who's gay, and there's a ceremony among his clan where the elders want to touch him because touching a homosexual's magic is a mm-hmm. lucky. You know, I tell my white gay friends this, and they're like, dang! Why can't I be a lucky charm? Why can't I be a breakfast cereal? But, you know, part of it, you know, I certainly growing up in a small town, growing up on a res, growing up Catholic, I mean, I carried a certain amount of homophobia into my adult life. But, I mean, that goes away so quickly.
Right.
And especially as I in the art world.
Yes. Well,
I mean,
absolutely.
I mean,
right.
You know, there would be no movies. There would be no books. There would be no visual art.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and also the big thing, it's very personal. My best friend. You know, the most important person in my life outside of my immediate family is a lesbian. So, I mean, she is, you know, my source of comfort and love and acceptance and tenderness. And she's one of the most amazing human beings I've ever known. So for anybody to think that she's less than, you know, I'm going to fight that violently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know. I'll go to war for my gay friends.
Amen to that. Me too. Amen.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely there.
Yeah.
I wonder when you think about these books, I think about, you know, that people can look at writers and go, you know, you are, what you're doing is supposed to be supposed to be transformative. It's supposed to change. Do you know what I'm saying? That's a common theme.
Yeah.
And on one hand, people say, oh, no, it's actually therapeutic. It's me running through my stuff. Or it's...
It's none of that and all of that.
Yeah. Yes.
I was talking. There were some really interesting questions at Goucher. I was very impressed. There was none of the usual stuff.
There's some great students there.
Yeah, nobody asked me about my writing process. You know, boring questions.
Really?
What books do you like to read? All of them.
Right. Do you write in the morning or at night?
Yeah, just boring. You know, they were, you know, one of them asked, you know, what do you hate about writing? You know, which nobody's ever asked me. Which was an intense.
What did you say?
Yeah, I said almost everything.
because of the discipline you have to give yourself to.
Yeah, and it's lonely.
Right.
I mean, and I explained about that. I explained my day.
Uh-huh.
You know, at home and then my day on the road. And the days on the road are the hard ones. I am Willie Loman.
I thought you liked Roman.
I like, to quote Dan Fogelberg.
Uh-huh.
The audiences are heavenly, the traveling is hell.
Okay. I can buy that. I buy that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love the people. I hate the travel.
Right.
I love getting there. I mean, I love being there.
Being there.
But I hate getting there.
Right. I understand.
Yeah. So the idea, I mean, all these ideas placed on me, you know, about what my work is supposed to be. But the amazing thing is, despite all my protestations about that, I mean, and as I was telling the students at Goucher, you know, I have changed Native American history.
Give us more. What do you mean?
There's never been a me. There's never been a famous Indian who's never picked up a rifle. I've never shot a gun.
Never? Even when you were a kid on the reg, you never shot a gun?
Nope.
That's interesting. Even as a kid. Interesting.
Oh, I did shoot shotgun trap shooting because our trap shooting team at the White High School, one of they couldn't find a fourth member.
So you had to be it.
So I had to be it because I was president of the Future Farmers of America. So they called
that's
me. Really,
that's only shocking because you think living in a rural area on the res that somebody would have said, hey.
No. Wasn't interested.
Wow. You were not interested.
No. Still not interested. You know, if I'm going to fight for my gay friends, I'm going to do it with my fists.
Gotcha.
And my sarcasm.
Right.
But you, Knuckles and sarcasm. That's my Indian name. But
Nom de guerre, knuckle sarcasm.
Yep, I'm going to give you knuckle sarcasm. But the places I've been, I mean, I'm a poet who has been on panels with presidents. You know, mm-hmm. I was on a panel with President Clinton. You know, I hang out with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar now and again. So the pop culture stuff I have, the way of looking at an Indian has changed. And, I mean, Smoke Signals, that movie has been seen by 99% of Indians.
Yes, absolutely. And yes.
And it's entered into the national consciousness of Indians.
Great movie. Yeah. I love that movie.
Yeah.
Everybody loves that movie.
So seen it. It's weird to say it, but, I mean, I have more social power in the Indian world. I'm Hemingway and Faulkner in the Indian world.
I'll grant that. I think that what you're saying is correct.
Yeah.
And I never thought about it that way, but I think you're right. And so what does that mean then? I mean, what does that mean in terms of you and your work? I mean, because that's also like laden with some responsibility.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, like you'd mentioned earlier, I've been on the Colbert Report twice.
Right.
And I stood toe-to-toe with him.
Yes, you did. He was. I can see by the look on his face that he didn't know. Is it when you the one time when you said, "Can I ask you a question?" But you're not supposed to. But he didn't know, but you kept coming back at him.
Yeah.
It stopped him, which is great. I loved it.
And
I love that.
But the thing is, I was able to do that because of growing up inside an incredibly storytelling, quick-witted, funny, sarcastic, ironic, politically motivated Native American community. So sitting there across from Stephen Colbert, whose training came from a very Western Civ American comedy background, and also a very intelligent man. But I was coming from an Indian background, storytelling background, very Indian, filtered through FFA debate team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, brand new. There's never been an Indian stand up to a pop culture figure like that.
Because you are a pop culture figure of your own.
Yeah, and nobody's ever done that. So, but it's weird because it sounds arrogant, but even in the moment, I'm going, whoa, because it's me and not me. I'm, you know, and the Indians who get mad at me or who dislike what I do, you know, or who question everything I do, I mean, they don't even, you know, I'm sort of the combination of all of us.
So if you, in some sense, is the embodiment of that, which I think has to be true, then if you extrapolate that out socially, culturally, politically in America, and you're taking this book, and this book has kind of grabbed a hold. If all these inner-city kids in Baltimore see this book, and it speaks to them because the struggle and the life is not that distant in some respects. So what does it say to the larger mass about what we need to do? Because everybody's not going to be the individual who walks out, I'm leaving the res, and I'm leaving the inner city, and I'm going to get a straight A's, and I'm going to go to Harvard. That'd be great, but it doesn't always happen. So what comes out of that beyond that?
You know, the first thing that occurred to me is not all your traditions are good. You can pick and choose.
Mm-hmm. And you have to to survive.
Yeah. You can say something screwed up. You can stay home and only choose as much of the good stuff as you can.
That's a hard thing to wrestle with.
Yeah.
And the society could do more. We could do more.
Picking and choosing.
And a larger cultural, social question is we could be investing more in so more kids can have those choices as a natural rite of passage. Like some kid who goes to Eton instead of the east side of Baltimore.
Yeah. And that's the chances of that happening increased dramatically with the New Deal.
Yes.
And with the Civil Rights Movement.
That's right.
And now they're decreasing rapidly. Because the country is turning libertarian and cannibalistic. I mean, these are the new robber barons.
Absolutely. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Sure, I wish we had another hour or so to do this. I'm really enjoying this. I might have to, when I come to Seattle, hock you some more to do some more of this.
All right.
It's been great to have you in the studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here in person again.
Good to see you, too. Sherman Alexie has been with us. The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. It's the One Maryland, One Book, 2011. The Maryland Humanities Council. And we'll put on our website where you can see him. Tonight he is running over to the Eastern Shore Chesapeake College at the Todd Performing Arts Center at 7 p.m. He'll be in Western Maryland on Friday, and then back in Baltimore Saturday, 2 o'clock, the Baltimore Book Festival, Literary Salon in Mount Vernon Place. You can call 410-685-0095 or just go down there and have a good time and meet him in a very personal kind of way. And Sherman, once again, brother, thank you so much for being in the studio. It's been great to see you again.
Thank you.
Thanks. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.